Side 7. A Separate War and Other Stories by Joe Haldeman. Continuing with Fantasy for 6 Electrodes and 1 Adrenaline Drip on page 231. Moreno. Her George. He worked for me once. I had to discharge him. Hazlick, still gazing over grounds. For a good reason, I'm sure. Moreno. He killed a man. Hazlick laughs, a short bark, and looks at Moreno wryly. Hazlick. You've never killed a man. Moreno snorts and walks a short distance away. He talks into the night. Moreno. I'm not talking about business. He killed this man for pleasure. Pause, subliminal, spiders crawling through filth. After making love to him. I later found... pause, that he had done it before, also to women. Hazlick, lightly. He seems a man well suited to his profession. Hazlick turns his back to the railing and studies the party below, through the glass doors. Sound, faint party noises. Hazlick, what has this to do with me? Moreno, everything and nothing. Turns, there will be murder here tonight. She wouldn't have brought him as a social ornament. Hazlick takes out a dope stick and has trouble waving it alight. Tied on Hazlick as he blows the tip into flame and sucks. Somatic. Dope, 0.40, then under to 0.10. Hazlick. This is the most private of private property on Earth. She will play her games, and there will be no trouble. Unless somebody wants to make trouble. With her, not many would. Moreno. Don't you care who is going to die in your own house? Hazlick. I don't care to know. Not ahead of time. Moreno. Not even if it's a friend or someone you love? Not even if it is yourself? Hazlick turns around again, slowly, and throws dope stick over balcony edge. He watches the spark fall and die. Hazlick. Frederica is bold, but she is not stupid. Pauses. Besides, how could you know who her intended is? Moreno. Shrugs. I don't, but I have men here too. Hazlick. Coldly. Were they invited? Moreno. Yes. You said to bring a friend. I brought a very good friend. So did Porphyry Esterbrook, and so did Hazlick. I see. How many? Moreno. Enough to isolate George and ask him some questions. Hazlick, to himself. You aren't doing this for my sake. Addresses Moreno directly, shade of menace. Exactly what is going on? Moreno. That also may be one of those things that you don't wish to know. Moreno sees Hazlick's face and realizes he's gone a little too far. Somatic, stomach tightening, and adrenaline, 0.20. Moreno, long pause, swallows. All right. A power struggle, so to speak. No, an extermination, speaking with passion for the first time. The old bitch has got to go. Our lives are too complicated, too uncertain. Get rid of her and... Hazlick. I believe she has been useful to me in the past. You've probably used her services too. One never remembers, of course. Moreno, angry. No, never. Hazlick. It certainly was convenient to your industry when Mademoiselle Lagrange passed on. Moreno. Yes. But I never would have hired that old hag to do it. It was a fortunate accident. Hazlick. Light laugh. Somehow evil. Our little world is full of accidents that turn out to favor one or the other of us. Frederica is behind most of them. Moreno. Face set. But not Mademoiselle Lagrange. Hazlick. As you wish. The two men stand in silence for 20 seconds. Hazlick takes out a dope stick and then returns it to the pack. Haslick. At any rate, you wish to enlist my aid against Frederica? Moreno. Not directly. I'd like some guarantee that you won't interfere, though. Haslick, silent. Do you still have those, small rooms underneath the place? Haslick, the soundproofed conference rooms? Of course. Would you like one? Moreno, yes, if we could get him. Haslick, I don't want to hear about it. Not until afterwards, and never unless it directly concerns me. Moreno, excellent. I'll tell. Haslick, wait. I go first. Haslick leaves. Cut to big close-up of Moreno, smiling now. Fade out to commercial. Commercial, 1 minute stiffener, copyright, spot. Fade in, establishing shot 3. Medium group shot of Frederica and George with several other people, talking. A white-coated servant glides up to Frederica and whispers something to her. She goes away with him. George begins to follow, but 3 men pass between them. Big close-up on right hand of first man, who is holding a small ampule. Tight two-shot of first man and George as first man squeezes ampule and a jet of colorless fluid sprays into George's face. It is come-along gas. Smell, ammonia. Feel, icy splash on face. George reaches out with left hand, but barely brushes man's arm. George gets a funny passive look. His hand drops back, and he stands still. First man, whispering, "Now, George, just follow us." Tight group shot of the 3 men herding George away. Camera follows for a short distance. Cut to medium two shot of Frederica and servant. She is arguing with him and doesn't notice George is headed the other way. Cut to long shot of downstairs room as 3 men and George enter. The walls and ceiling are covered with a mossy substance, the soundproofing. There is a conference table in the center of the room. The chair at the end of the table has manacles attached to the arms. Smell, dry, chemical odor of soundproofing. Subliminal. Feel, scratchy, dry moss. Smell, brimstone and rotting flesh. Adrenaline, 0.10 and out. Camera follows first man and George to the end of the table. First man, you sit here. Tight on first man as he grips edge of table, wobbles. Somatic, extreme nausea, fire in right arm. Second man, off. What's wrong? First man, I don't know. He must have gotten choking sound. Medium group shot as first man falls to floor, begins jerking around. Second man moves to help him, stops, looks up at George, who is watching the whole thing with quiet interest. Second man to George, did you do that? George, innocent smile, yes, nerve poison. Tight on first man as he expires noisily, messily on floor. Smell, vomit, subliminal, taste of vomit, extreme nausea, somatic, whiteout. Third man, God. Second man, swallows, trying to stay calm. How did you do it? George, I told you, nerve poison. Third man, let's fasten him down and loosen him up. Second man, so do it, the manacles. Third man gives second man a hard glance, goes cautiously to George. He stands just out of arm reach. Third man, put your arms up on the arms of the chair. George obeys without hesitation, but moving slowly. Adrenaline, 0.15. Third man, all right, stay that way. Adrenaline, 0.25. George's hands are lying palm up on the chair arms. Big close-up, as third man turns right hand over and latches manacle. Sound, loud click, and subliminal, metal tightness around wrist, over wrist. He reaches for left hand and George closes hand over his. Micro close-up shows fingernail slitting flesh. Tight two-shot of George and third man as third man jerks his hand away. Third man, ouch! touches cut to mouth. Some fingernails, this guy. Sharp intake of breath. He. Big close-up on third man's face. Adrenaline, 0.35. Second man, off. Sit down. Don't move. I'll get some atropine. Long group shot. George watches passively as second man runs from room. Third man sits down cautiously. Adrenaline, 0.40. Third man. Will atropine work? George. If he gets back in time. Adrenaline, 0.50 and out. Cut to tight group shot of Moreno, Haslick, and others sitting at crystal table playing dice. Second man hurries up to Moreno, whispers. Moreno, to Haslick, across. Do you have any atropine in the place? Intercut close-ups, Haslick and Moreno. Haslick, counting money, annoyed. What? Moreno, atropine. A drug overdose. Haslick, to second man. There might be some. Ask the butler. Haslick, to Moreno. One of your men popping on duty? Moreno. Not really. It's more concerned with what we discussed earlier. Haslick. The woman? Moreno. Her man, actually. Haslick stands casually. Let's go take a look. Cut to long shot past Moreno and Haslick standing in door of conference room. Third man is sitting with his arms wrapped around himself, deathly pale. George is exactly as we left him, one wrist manacled, monumentally unconcerned with everything. Corpse of first man has skin like marble, has gone into rigor mortis. Note, ask State Correction Board whether we can get two young terminals to play the parts of first and third men. Adrenaline, 0.50. Somatic, subliminal. Nausea and angina. Smell, vomit and feces. Third man. Atropine? Haslick. Brusque. Maybe. Coming. Moreno. What did he do? Prater said something about his hand. Third man. I don't think it's a hand. It's a brus. Nerve. Poison under the finger. Nails. Sharp. Oh, God. Third man flops down on floor, rigid, and begins beating arm on floor. He jerks several times, vomits explosively, and dies. Smell, as before, up and down. Stinger of adrenaline, 0.80 and out. Subliminal, drowning in filth. Medium two-shot of Haslick and Moreno standing in door, staring. Prater, second man, runs up to them from behind. Prater, out of breath. I've got the... Oh. Smell, down to strong subliminal. Haslick. Let me have that. Speaks into bracelet. Sandler, this is the boss. Got some garbage to be taken out. In Conference A. Listens. That's right. Turns a micro dial on the bracelet. Johns, this is the boss. Get an interrogation team down to Conference A sooner. Listens. Doesn't make too much difference. Right. To nobody in particular. It had to come to this, sooner or later. Haslick, to Moreno. You were right. We've allowed Frederica too much. Moreno. Yes. To Prater. You can go. Prater shuffles, lost, down the hall, and Haslick and Moreno stand outside door and smoke. Somatic, dope, 0.25. Subliminal, fade to out. Four men hustle up with stretchers and a sanitizer. They go straight through the door without saying a word to either man. High-pitched, humming sanitizer sound. Haslick shouts over. Haslick, stay away from the man in the chair! Closes door sound out abruptly. Haslick sits down on floor, then Moreno does also. Soon the four men come back out, bearing the stretchers. Again they show no sign of seeing the two. Haslick. Just when everything was going so well. Pause, unsentimentally. Moreno, do you consider yourself a happy man? Moreno, uncomfortable. Well, I suppose so. I have all that I need, and I keep busy. Haslick, looking at Atropine Sarette, fiddling with it. Until a few weeks ago, I would never have called myself happy. There was a strange, with sudden vehemence, adrenaline 0.25. A weight on my soul, Moreno. An actual weight of, I don't know, sorrow, guilt, questioning whether I might not have been different. Pause. But one day, 3 weeks, a month ago, I woke up one morning and it was all gone. I was free. That's when I decided to throw a party. Pause. But now I feel it coming back. Sound of footsteps approaching. Haslick looks up. Haslick, getting up. Ah, Johns, we have a little problem. Medium group shot past Haslick and Moreno to the interrogation team. Johns and his two assistants, Friedman, male, and O'Hara, female. Johns.
We'll do what we can, sir. Have you met O'Hara and Friedman?
Haslick.
No, I haven't.
Johns.
They're very good.
Haslick, with a wave of his hand. I trust your judgment in these things. Follow me. All five enter the conference room. Haslick walks over to stand, not too near, by George. Haslick.
This man works for Frederica Oblimov.
George?
George.
Yes?
Haslick.
What sort of work do you do for Frederica?
George, small smile.
I am her husband.
Haslick, to Moreno.
What did they drug him with?
Moreno.
If they followed my instructions, it was come-along gas.
Haslick.
Makes sense. He doesn't really have to tell the truth, then, not even to a direct order.
Johns.
We can fix that, sir.
Haslick, impatiently.
Of course you can. But nothing so crude as dissolvers or triplescop. I want to be able to return him to Frederica no worse for wear, except for a lack of memory of these proceedings. Can you do that?
Johns, doubtful.
How soon would he have to be returned?
Haslick.
No more than an hour.
Johns.
I don't know. That lets out most of our drugs. We can keep him on come-along, of course, and he won't remember, but it won't make him talk.
O'Hara.
Let me work on him.
Johns.
All right.
O'Hara approaches George without caution.
Haslick. Watch out! His left hand's a pross. Nerve poison underneath the fingernails.
O'Hara to George. Sultry.
Now, George, is that right?
George. Little boy smile.
Uh-huh.
O'Hara.
Now, George, turn your hand over, palm down, and don't touch me while I fasten your arm to the chair.
George.
All right.
O'Hara binds him without any trouble.
O'Hara to Haslick.
Exactly what do you want to know?
Haslick.
He's here to kill somebody. You know about Frederica's contracts?
She nods.
I want to find out who the victim is supposed to be, and who contracted for it, if he knows.
O'Hara, softly.
George, who did you come here to kill?
George, sing-song.
I'm not supposed to tell.
O'Hara,
you can tell me, George. I'll keep it a secret.
George, petulant.
Huh-uh.
O'Hara looks up.
Friedman, bring the kid over.
Haslick.
No marks.
Johns.
Don't worry, sir. They're too good for that.
Friedman, crossing over.
That's right, sir. Direct stimulation of the pain centers in the brain. The newest thing. Doesn't leave a sign.
O'Hara.
Now this man is going to hurt you, George. I can't stop him from hurting you unless you tell me whom you came here to kill. And why?
George giggles.
He can't hurt me. Frederica told me. Nobody can hurt me if I don't want.
Friedman.
Probably a simple hypnotic injunction.
Squeezes George's earlobe between finger and thumbnail.
No reaction. Well?
Friedman opens up black case, brings out a small, limp net of wire mesh. He shakes it out.
I think this will bypass it.
Friedman lays net over George's head and secures it with a chin strap. He takes out a little box with a dial on it. Friedman to O'Hara.
Ready?
O'Hara licks lips, staring at George intently. Yes. Big close-up of little box. Friedman turns dial to first setting. Big close-up on George's face. Beads of sweat break out on his forehead. Somatic subliminal. Steel band tightening around chest. Dolly back to tight two-spot. Faces of George and O'Hara. Somatic. Female sexual tension, 0.20. O'Hara. It hurts, doesn't it, George?
George. Small voice.
Yes, it hurts.
O'Hara.
Whom are you going to kill?
George. Childish defiance.
That's for me to know and you to find out.
O'Hara glances at Friedman, and he adjusts dial upward with audible click.
Hold subliminal and add subliminal, little finger being pushed back to breaking point. Big close-up on O'Hara's face, smiling. Sharp intake of breath from George. Off.
O'Hara.
Whom are you going to kill?
George.
Stop it. Make him stop it.
O'Hara.
Whom are you going to kill?
George.
Make him stop.
O'Hara, moving even closer to George, smiling.
More.
Hold subliminal and add subliminal. Knitting needle being pushed through thigh. George moans.
Somatic. Female sexual tension 0.40. Big close-up on O'Hara, panting through her nose, teeth clenched.
O'Hara.
Whom are you going to kill?
George.
I can't say.
O'Hara.
More?
Click and hold subliminal and add subliminal. Extreme pressure on testicles.
Somatic.
Female sexual tension 0.75. Medium two-shot of George and O'Hara. George has head thrown back, features contorted, screaming. O'Hara leaning over him, hands on his forearms, shouting into his face.
O'Hara. At the top of her lungs.
Whom are you going to kill? Whom are you going to kill? Whom are you going to kill?
Haslick. Off. Whispers.
God.
Friedman. Calmly. Academically. This level of pain is greater than that experienced by one who burns to death.
Johns. Slightly bothered.
You might as well try something else. This isn't going to work.
Friedman.
You're probably right.
George's screams stop abruptly. Subliminals out.
O'Hara.
Whom are you going to kill? Whom are you going to kill? Whom are you?
O'Hara slips lithely off him and holds hand out to Friedman.
O'Hara. Quickly.
Friedman hands her a small ampule. She grabs George by the hair. His head is lolling and he's whimpering like a child, and holds his head up while she crushes ampule under his nose. Immediate somatic. Male sexual tension, 0.70.
Smell,
full-strength stiffener, copyright.
O'Hara, teasing, grotesquely.
I've got something you want.
George looks at her sickly and takes in ragged breath.
Somatic, male sexual tension, 0.75.
George, hoarsely.
Come here.
O'Hara,
not until you tell me. Whom did Frederica order you to kill?
Full body shot of O'Hara past George. O'Hara pulls shift over her head and underneath is wearing only a little wisp of bright material which clings wetly to her. She has a ripe young figure, shiny with perspiration.
Somatic.
Male sexual tension 0.85. Painful erection.
O'Hara.
Who?
George shakes his head violently, incapable of speech or not trusting himself.
A little saliva has trickled out of the corner of his mouth.
O'Hara approaches him and kneels, begins caressing the back of his hand with her breast.
Feel.
Featherlight touch of breast on back of hand, which is struggling to clutch but unable to turn over.
Somatic.
Male sexual tension 0.93.
Smell.
Female, male, musk. O'Hara. Just one little name, and I'll take care of you. O'Hara stands and turns her back to George. Slowly slides final garment down. Somatic, male sexual tension, 0.95. O'Hara, facing away. Just tell me, George. George groans something intelligible. O'Hara turns and in a quick, smooth motion, mounts his hand and begins rubbing back and forth. Feel, slippery labia, unnaturally hot and wet. Smell, female musk, up. Somatic, male sexual tension, 0.99, unbearable, gut-wrenching frustration. O'Hara, huskily. If you want. George screams.
Haslick! Haslick!
Feel, smell, somatic, all out. O'Hara slides off George and slips back into clothes. Feel, wetness on back of hand, turning cold and sticky, as Haslick crosses in blind fury. Adrenaline, 0.75. Haslick, barely controlled.
You are going to die.
Tight two-shot, Haslick and George. Haslick has produced a shooter and is holding it at George's head. He lowers aim, pointing it at his groin.
And it's up to you whether you die quickly or in great agony.
George.
Don't kill.
Haslick.
Who ordered the contract? Who wants me dead?
George.
I don't know. She never tells me. Please, please don't kill.
Moreno. Off.
He's probably telling the truth, Haslick.
Haslick thumbs safety on shooter. It begins to hum. Adrenaline. Down to 0.50. Haslick.
You're right.
Haslick turns to face Moreno and drops shooter in tunic pocket. Adrenaline, 0.35.
Haslick. Let's go talk to Frederica.
Johns.
Shall we kill him?
Haslick.
Eventually.
To O'Hara, leering.
You may practice on him first. Don't worry about marks.
Cut to main room again. Party going full swing, people laughing and chattering. Frederica is seated near the bar, looking deadly. Dolly in for tight group shot as Haslick and Moreno approach. Sound under and hold adrenaline. Frederica, coldly to Haslick.
Where is my husband?
Haslick.
He's enjoying his own private party right now.
Moreno.
And being positively garrulous.
Frederica.
Oh? I'm glad to hear that. I was afraid he wasn't having a very good time.
Moreno hisses.
He's still...
Haslick, interrupting.
He talked, Frederica. I know he came here to kill me. You came here to kill me.
Frederica whispers.
You fool. Both of you fools.
Moreno.
No, dear, for a change, you play the fool. This time you went too far.
Frederica, venomous.
If you kill me, an army will be at your door by dawn.
Haslick,
by dawn I will have an army here to meet them.
Moreno,
two armies.
Haslick,
perhaps, though, if you will tell me who contracted for my death.
Frederica,
you know I can't do that.
Haslick,
this one time, this last time, you had better.
Frederica, looking at Moreno.
Alone?
Haslick.
All right, to Moreno. You will excuse us?
Moreno makes exaggerated bow. Frederica and Haslick leave wordlessly. Moreno watches them go and speaks softly into his bracelet. Cut to, tight two-shot of Frederica and Haslick, alone in a corridor. Haslick opens an ornate, old-fashioned manual door. Haslick.
Riley. My chambers.
Long shot past Haslick and Frederica to opulent bedroom, a fantasy of glass and velvet and silk. Subliminal, feel of velvet and silk, sound of fine glass tinkling. Slight smell, dope. Somatic, dope, 0.08. A tall, beautiful girl sits naked on the couch by the bed, smoking dope and reading. Unruffled, she puts down the viewer and slips a house coat over her shoulders, crosses to exit between Haslick and Frederica.
Haslick, I'll call for you later,
motions to Frederica.
Have a seat, dear.
Haslick crosses to a large bar and selects a fine decanter.
Haslick. Brandy?
Frederica.
Just a taste.
Haslick pours two small glasses of brandy, his back to Frederica, watching her in a mirror. She doesn't move. He reaches in tunic pocket and takes out his shooter. Sound, soft hum, still activated. He crosses to Frederica with shooter in right hand and drink in left.
Haslick. Distilled from the finest Antarian vintage.
Frederica accepts, not looking at shooter, and takes a small sip.
Frederica. It travels well.
Haslick returns to the bar and gets his glass, then sits on bed about 2 meters from Frederica. He empties the glass in one swallow. Taste and smell, fine brandy. Somatic, liquor burning on its way down.
Haslick. Well,
Frederica.
The man who contracted for your death is one of my oldest and most valued customers.
Haslick.
Was.
As our friend pointed out, you are no longer in the business.
Pauses.
You may yet live, though.
Frederica laughs softly.
You can't allow me to live.
Takes a long, slow sip of brandy.
Neither can Moreno.
Frederica reaches up and takes a long pin out of her hair. The hair falls in a soft white cascade around her shoulders. She was very beautiful once.
Haslick, raising shooter.
That pin is a weapon.
Frederica.
With proper knowledge, anything is a weapon.
Pauses.
Don't worry. I won't throw it at you.
Haslick. More of your nerve poison?
Frederica.
Oh, you found out George's little secret. How many men did it take?
Haslick. 2. We have atropine now, though.
Takes ampule out of his pocket and shows it to her.
You might as well tell me who your customer was. If nothing else, I can promise you a pleasant death.
Frederica.
Having made a lifelong study of the subject, I can assure you that there is no such thing as a pleasant death. Not even painless death is pleasant. Not even for an 80-year-old woman.
Frederica stands and begins walking. For once, she looks as old as she is. Camera follows as she talks, fiddling with the pin.
Frederica.
You don't recall the last time you contracted for my services?
Haslick. Off.
Of course not.
Frederica.
It was a most unusual request. Also very difficult. But I accepted the challenge.
Haslick. Off.
So? You were paid well, no?
Frederica.
I wouldn't have risked it if it hadn't meant so much to you. I've always respected you, Theo. Loved you in my own way.
Adrenaline 0.20. Subliminal. Rattlesnake coiling.
Frederica.
You were very disturbed, agitated. You had tried a multitude of other possible solutions before coming to me. None of them was satisfactory.
Adrenaline 0.40. Subliminal. Guillotine rising. Rusty squeak.
Haslick. Off.
What has this to do?
Frederica.
Patience. Old people do rattle on.
Frederica stops walking, a little more than an arm's length from Haslick. Adrenaline 0.50. Subliminal. Losing balance on edge of cliff.
Frederica.
You were afraid that your empire was going to crumble because of the weakness of one man.
Frederica points pin at Haslick as if for emphasis. Adrenaline 0.60. Subliminal. Tied to stake and flames licking at feet.
Frederica.
You arranged for that man to be killed. 1 month ago,
This night, you arranged it. Because he had just turned 50, and was sad and afraid, and knew that his empire soon would be down around his ears, and was not strong enough to commit suicide. He, you, Theo, you hired me to be your instrument of suicide. Frederica rests point of pen lightly on Hazlick's chest. Adrenaline, 0.70, subliminal, falling in darkness. Hazlick, you're insane. Frederica, no, Theo. Your subconscious knows. Put down the shooter. Hazlick puts muzzle of shooter against Frederica's abdomen. Adrenaline 0.85, hold subliminal. Frederica, no difference. Frederica leans on the needle, and at the same instant, Hazlick fires. Frederica explodes, cut in two. Total sensory null, as Hazlick stares at Pin, a couple of centimeters sticking into his chest. He drops the shooter into the confusion of gore all over the rug and takes the atropine ampule out of his pocket. Then Hazlick throws the ampule away and shoves the pin the rest of the way into his chest. Adrenaline, 1.0. Somatic, male orgasm, 1.0. Smell, taste, feel, hear, sight, all up with white noise. 2. Full sensory overload. Fade to black. Credits. Commercial. 1972. Notes on the stories. The title story of this collection ran a winding path from conception to delivery. Like one of the others here, it started with a letter from my old friend Robert Silverberg, inviting me to write a story for an anthology. This was Far Horizons, with the daunting subtitle, All New Tales from the Greatest Worlds of Science Fiction. He was asking writers who had created classics in the genre to revisit their worlds and write novellas set in them. In my case, it was the Forever War, and it was a wonderful opportunity. Editors and others had been after me for 20 years to write a sequel to the novel, and my response had always been no, the novel's complete as it stands. But I always wanted to write a novella about what happens after the novel ends, and here was Silverberg offering me the chance, and for more money than the novel's original advance. I got 20 or 30 pages into it, though, a novella I was calling Forever Free, when I realized that it begged to be expanded into a novel, an actual sequel. I wrote Silverberg and asked how soon the material could be reused, and he said 3 years. That was too long. It was time for me to send out the next book proposal. So I turned Forever Free into the book proposal, same title, and looked for another angle on the novella. It was immediately apparent. In the last part of the book, the main characters, Mary Gay and William, are separated, and we follow William's story. What happened to Mary Gay? It was fun to write her story, both as a bridge to the sequel and as an oblique commentary on the Forever War 20 years later. I don't often write fantasy, except insofar as science fiction is a subset of fantasy, but every now and then a fantasy idea tickles my fancy. I got a request from Jean Rabe to write a story for Renaissance Fair, a book of stories set in those odd, modern worlds of make-believe. I'm not a big fan of the anachronistic gatherings, but my wife loves them, and I let her drag me along and do enjoy myself once I get there, the mead and junk food and interesting costumes and old music. The music gave me an entree into a story. For years, I've had in my Crazy Ideas file a clipping from Acoustic Guitar Magazine about the lives and times of those odd performers who hire out as sidemen. Mostly unsung heroes of live music and records who sit in to fill lacunae in visiting bands or to beef up the background for a recording session. It's a precarious life, but full of variety, and as a freelance writer, I feel a kind of bond with people who wind up there. I've also been an amateur musician since grade school, and in a couple of insane periods in my youth, considered doing it for a living. Fortunately, no amount of yearning can make up for a lack of talent, so I was never given an opportunity to ruin my life in that particular way. One of the pleasures of writing stories, though, is the license to put on a manic disposition and imagine who you might have become if things had worked out differently. Diminished chord, let me venture out into that territory. Giza is one of two stories that appear here, courtesy of my classes at MIT. I start out the semester with an assignment that seems arbitrary, even cruel. I give each student a theme chosen at random from the table of contents of Peter Nichols's excellent The Science in Science Fiction, and make them write the opening couple of pages of a story based on that. If you don't know anything about antimatter or generation ships or werewolves, hey, look it up. You didn't get to MIT from a coupon on a cereal box. As partial compensation during the break in the middle of the 3-hour meeting, I have them get together and agree on whatever topic seems to be the worst and give it to me to write. This particular year, the students were especially cruel and made one up. Asteroid psychology. I said sure, and then wandered off to wonder what I had gotten into. The psychology of a rock? The book Writing the Natural Way by Gabriel Rico has some interesting tips. And one I pass on to my students is the idea of trying to visualize a story by making a graphic map of its characters, ideas, settings, whatever, a way to get your brain out of thinking of a story as a sentence-by-sentence structure and seeing it as a broader gestalt. I did that, writing Asteroid inside a circle on the left and Psychology inside a circle on the right, and then free-associated on the two words, trying to find a commonality. I doubt that I spent 15 minutes on it before the idea for the story crystallized almost entire. An asteroid can't have a psychology, but the people trapped inside one could, and it would be toxic. The time of writing is relevant. It was the week after 11 September 2001. Foreclosure was another story from the random topic assignment, but this past year the students were more kind and merely gave me a topic that was so overworked it seemed impossible to come up with anything new. Terraforming, changing inhospitable planets into Earth-like ones. Sometimes this writer-teacher's life isn't too rough. The day after that class, my wife and I got on a plane to Barcelona, where I was to give a speech and then take it easy for a while. Two old friends, Joan Manel and Mercé, had traded their flat in the city for a beach house in Cubelles, the resort town to the north, and they invited us to kick back and relax for a week. So there I was, sitting on a blanket on this gorgeous topless beach, not a cloud in the sky or a care in the world, and of course my thoughts turned to terraforming. Because deep inside this jet-setting sybarite is an American Puritan workaholic. I took out my Moleskine notebook, that I should even have it on the beach condemns me as hopeless, and decided to make a list of every terraforming theme I could remember, and see whether that would generate an idea for a new one. It worked. The list, which didn't take a half an hour of Spanish sun, is kind of interesting. Playing God, the ultimate in pollution, unwitting horror, greed, insane colonialism, need to abandon Earth, geometric increase, von Neumann machines, Earth as a result of terraforming, accidental terraforming, garbage taking over, terraforming as trivial hobby, aliens xenoforming Earth, doing Mars, Venus, Luna for mining, etc., moon partially terraformed, Earth retro-terraformed after disaster, very slow terraforming. Which led to the story. I wrote down, maybe nobody has done this one. Terraforming on such a slow scale that it looks like planetary evolution. The aliens come back to claim Earth now that it's done, and their claim is legal. Humans are an accidental byproduct and are screwing up the process. They have to be educated so they know why they're being destroyed. Foreclosure. People have 1,000 years to leave the Earth. I chose as a viewpoint character my late mother-in-law, a wonderful woman who left a bad marriage and reinvented herself as a hotshot real estate agent. Four Short Novels was another story generated by a Robert Silverberg request. The French publisher, Flammarion, wanted an anthology of stories that take place 1,000 years from 2001, called Destination 3001. Unspecific enough that I could say yes and table it until an idea occurred to me. This is unusual. I don't have the faintest idea where the story came from, but I know the exact instant when it occurred to me. I'm a fairly serious bicyclist, and one chore bicyclists do is interval training, which is a fancy way of saying go up hills. I was laboring up one beautiful hill here in Gainesville, Florida, trying to keep my cadence up without descending into granny gears, when the structure of the whole story came to me in a hyper-oxygenated flash. By the time I finished with the hills, I knew what the first and last sections of it would be, and wrote a paragraph describing them as soon as I got home. I wasn't able to write it right away, though, because I was racing a deadline on the novel The Coming. I got that put away, and we hopped on a plane to Australia for the World Science Fiction Convention in Melbourne. After that convention, we were invited up to Airlie Beach, a lovely resort town just off the Great Barrier Reef, which we'd visited back in the 80s with Australian fan and critic Eric Lindsay. Eric had had the good sense to move there, and he invited a small mob of us up to continue the party that had started in Melbourne a week before. I suppose the old Puritan gland, again awakened by cloudless skies and topless women, drove me once more to my notebook, and I wrote the story in 3 or 4 easy mornings. Perhaps I ought to move to a topless beach and start making a living as a short story writer. For White Hill is probably the most complex story in this book, and is my personal favorite for various reasons. Greg Benford wrote to 5 hard science fiction writers. As a short definition, you can say that hard SF uses real science, and asked us to write novellas for an anthology called Far Futures, stories set at least 1,000 years from now. Looking back at the notes for this story, I see that initially I had suggested a much different one concerning time travel. Here's a letter to Greg, who is a professional physicist. Many thanks for yours of 12 July re Lyapunov exponents, etc. I'm late answering because it arrived just after we left for Europe, Sweden and Denmark. Loverly. It's an interesting constraint. Tell me whether I might get around it in this wise. Chaos nudges the planets around so that their position is basically unknowable beyond a few million years of launch time. This does play hob with my wanting to have each jump orders of magnitude longer than the previous one. Or does it? After the first couple of jumps, a mere few thousand years into the future, it would be duck soup for them to enclose a snazzy spaceship inside the time machine's radius of influence. Here you go, right off the rack. Our hero takes care of Chaos, etc., by zooming up orthogonal to the plane of the ecliptic and doing his time traveling way up there, deliberately missing the Earth by tens of AUs. Then he finds Earth and goes back down and lands to see what the Morlocks are up to. Furthermore, the protagonist has planned for this ahead of time. He knows he's on a one-way leap into the unknown, and he's gambling that technology will save him before Chaos destroys him. What a guy. Possible? Let's have a glass of good wine in San Francisco and mumble over these and other things. You have a deadline yet? That turned out to be the novel I'm writing now, 12 years later, The Accidental Time Machine. I'd forgotten that Greg was in on its inception. I drifted over into another direction, though. I'd been thinking about writing a novella about the future of art, anyhow, so why not do it for Greg? The structure of it, I stole from the best of sources. When I was in the middle of the book Forever Peace, I was slowly reading The Art of Shakespeare's Sonnets by Helen Vendler. I had real issues, as they say, with her approach to the text, but it was a good read and a good way to start writing in the morning. I would copy out a sonnet by hand, and then read her analysis while the tea was brewing, and then turn to my own book with the same pen. Some of us hard science guys slightly believe in magic. In the course of that exercise, I noticed that some of the sonnets had a compelling narrative thrust. In particular, number 18, possibly the best known poem in the language. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? I decided I would write a novella in 14 sections, each one based on a line of that poem. I wanted to make it just possible for a careful reader to figure out the source. Numbering the sections 1 through 14 would make it too easy, so I invented a base 14 number system to be decoded. The title, For White Hill, is another clue. Shakespeare dedicated the 1609 printing of the sonnets to W.H., their only begetter. Finally, the short last section is a pretty direct evocation of the final line, So long lives this, and this gives life to thee. There's also a writing pun in the names of the main characters, Waterman and Mont Blanc, roughly White Hill, were the brands of fountain pens used to write the story. I know that's beyond the pale. For anybody with a morbid interest in the calculations and logic that go into a story like this, I put 8 pages of notes at http://home.earthlink.net/tilda-haldeman/forwhitehillnotes.htm. I trust the story can be enjoyed without all that stuff, though. The plot for Finding My Shadow also came from verse, but this time a popular song. Along with a number of other science fiction writers, I met singer-songwriter Janice Ian at a World Science Fiction Convention in Montreal. She had been in correspondence with Mike Resnick over one of his stories, and he talked her into coming. We were all kind of fascinated by her bubbly enthusiasm. I mean, half the people I know are science fiction writers, so they're no big deal. And delighted when she subsequently sent a bunch of us a stack of her CDs with the suggestion, Mike Resnick's idea, that we write stories based on the lyrics for a book eventually called Stars. Her Here in the City suggested to me a dark vision of urban apocalypse, which I placed below and within my beloved second home, Boston. Civil Disobedience is another urban apocalypse, this time set in the Washington area, where I lived from grade school through high school graduation and later for 5 years of college. Ernest Lilly was putting together an anthology of future Washington stories, and knowing I'd grown up there, asked me for one. I said sure, and more or less forgot about it. The deadline just came due as I was starting to write these story notes, so I tabled them and wrote it. I'm not alone in being angry at and scandalized by the current administration, so a story set in Washington had to be political. The immediate impetus of it was the establishment's blithe dismissal of warnings from mainstream British scientists that catastrophic flooding from global warming could be only a few years away. I suppose they think they will be saved by the rapture or their fortunes. Now we come to two stories that were written to illustrate paintings. I was waxing nostalgic for the days when a science fiction magazine editor would send you a photocopy of a painting that would be on the cover someday and have you write a story around it. I once won a Hugo for one of those, Tricentennial, in the July 76 Analog. Gordon Van Gelder, editor of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, heard my plea, bought a painting he liked, and sent a copy to me. The artist, Max Bertolini, gave me permission to publish a link to a copy of it. http://home.earthlink.net/tilda-haldeman/fsf_art.jpg. It's a good painting and suggests any number of stories. Two scientific problems presented themselves immediately. The air has a green cast, and the shadows indicate that there are two suns. So only a certain set of orbits would work, and I had to postulate some aliens who could breathe chlorine, or at least tolerate it in a concentration where it was visible. A human can't, nor can any living organism I know of. It was an effective weapon in World War I because it would sink down into trenches and bunkers and poison people in fairly low concentrations. So I jury-rigged a planet and some aliens who could live there, and who might construct the huge stone artifacts in the cover illustration. For those of you who don't have a computer at your elbow, it's two space-suited people looking up at three identical large alien faces carved out of rock, with a tank-like vehicle behind them. Memento Mori was an interesting challenge from Dave Gross, who had just taken over the editorship of the venerable Amazing Magazine. Among the new things he wanted to do was a feature called 1,000 Words, where an author would be given a picture and asked to write 1,000-word story. Not 999 words, or 1,001, but exactly 1,000. It seemed difficult, but not impossible. I do a lot of formal poetry with more or less arbitrary restrictions, and in fact I'd done exactly 100-word stories, called drabbles, twice for a British charity. Dave sent me 4 paintings, and I chose the one by David Rankin, who kindly allowed me to post a scanning of it at http://home.earthlink.net /tilda/haldeman/mmorey.jpg. Brochure and Heartwired were both written as short diversions for a series in the science journal Nature. All the editor required was that they be amusing, short, and contain some actual science. The first, Brochure, was part of a Millennium Project. The series was well enough received that they did a repeat. It's kind of humbling to have a story in a magazine most of whose contents you have no chance of understanding. Out of Phase is the first science fiction story I sold back in 1969, and Power Complex was its 1970 sequel. They didn't appear in earlier collections of my short stories because I intended for them to be the first two chapters of a novel. I kept them in the back of my mind for a while, but after 30-some years, the back of my mind got pretty far back. I looked at them while putting together the stories for this volume and realized with a shock that I can't use them for that novel anymore, because their main character is too similar to the changeling in my 2004 novel, Camouflage. I had unconsciously plagiarized myself. There's a lesson for beginning writers in the history of Out of Phase. It's the first story I wrote in a fiction writing course I took my last semester in college. I got an A. The other SF story I wrote for the class became an episode in the Twilight Zone series. Right after that semester, I graduated and was drafted and sent to Vietnam. Like most other draftees who went there, I spent 1 year in combat and then came back to a month's leave. So-called compassionate leave, which I think means that your family, rather than the army, gets to deal with your problems. One thing I did that month was type up those two stories and send them out to the science fiction magazines. I was rejected by both Analog and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. But when Frederick Pohl at Galaxy saw Out of Phase, he sent me a little note saying that if I could boil the first four pages down to one, he'd look at it again. In fact, I boiled those pages down to the one word, trapped. I sent it back and knew from magazines about writing that I should include a cover letter with a bare minimum of information. It went like this. Dear Mr. Pohl, here is the story with the changes you requested. It turned out, though, that Mr. Pohl had quit as editor of Galaxy, and his last-minute replacement was a man who hadn't seen a science fiction magazine in 20 years. He didn't know Haldeman from Heinlein, so when my story came in with that cover letter, he probably bought it without even reading it. The lesson to the beginning writer is clear. Just keep track of magazines hiring and firing in journals like Locus and Publishers Weekly. When somebody leaves a magazine, shoot his or her successor a story with a cover letter addressed to the recently departed. Here is the story with the changes you requested could start you on a career that could result, 35 years later, in a confession like this. I started writing just a little too late to get into Harlan Ellison's groundbreaking anthologies Dangerous Visions and again Dangerous Visions. Fantasy for 6 electrodes and 1 adrenaline drip, written in 1972, was going to be in the last Dangerous Visions, and make my name a household word. I could have been the father of cyberpunk 7 years before William Gibson's Johnny Mnemonic. Or maybe not. At any rate, the last of the Dangerous anthologies never saw print. I lost this story for ages, since it was written before computers made it easy to keep track of things. Then the University of South Florida offered to collect my papers, which sent me rummaging through dusty old boxes. In one of the boxes, I found a carbon. That's what we used when Xerox was the name of a villain in Buck Rogers of the story, and I still like it, though perhaps it's more quaint now than dangerous. Joe Haldeman, Gainesville, Florida, 2005.